little over a week.
All right.
So, your dad was a pastor. How about your grandfather?
No, my grandfather's, one was an immigrant from Denmark, and then the other one was a postal worker.
Okay.
My dad was. So, it was Kathy's got like clergy going back maybe six generations.
Yeah.
From Germany. So, there were four brothers that came, you know, gosh, 1850s. You know, and then kind of scattered in the Midwest. Yeah. So my dad would have been the first, for sure. Yeah.
Pockets are great.
Hi, Cynthia. Welcome, welcome. Great seats down front.
Start us out with a short mindfulness meditation. And this is a practice in what the next hour is going to be all about, which is noticing. So I invite everybody to just find your seat. I know sometimes these chairs can be a little uncomfortable. It can help to put that cushion on the back of it too, double up. I really appreciate that. But just make sure that your back feels supported enough. Now you're able to start to release some of that muscle tension that we all come in with. And I want to invite you to leave your hands on your, you know, armrest, your legs, whatever feels most comfortable to you. Feel your feet on the ground. And I just want to invite you to take a couple of long, deep breaths. Just notice the feeling of air coming in and going out of your body. Notice the feeling of your feet on the ground, your body in your chair. And allow yourself to drop your shoulders. Let some of that tension go. And notice if you have any tension in your face or your neck, and allow that to just drop. And as you feel your breath, I invite you to notice anything you came into this room with today. Whatever it was, it could be a thought, a feeling, a worry, a burden. Something in your body that you were carrying. And after noticing it, I want it to know that it's welcome here today. All parts of you are welcome in this room. Let's take one more deep breath. And just arrive here together. Thank you all for showing up. All of my parts are very grateful that all of your parts are here today. I'm going to explain a little bit about what that means. Do I contradict myself? Has anyone heard that line? Do I contradict myself? Does anyone know the rest of it? Do I contradict myself? Very well then, I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. That was Walt Whitman. What comes to mind when you think of that? Yeah, I contradict myself.
All the time.
All the time. And is that okay?
It is okay.
Yeah.
It has to be okay.
Oh boy. Some people say it's not okay. And we all think that it's not okay at some time. That we have to be decisive. We need to be consistent. We need to be strong. We need to be all something. And the thing that I've been learning about in the last year doesn't really believe that. And I'd love to talk about all the different ways that we've arrived at this idea of being multiple, of having multitudes, and what that invites us to do. Because a lot of people might be a little intimidated by that idea. Well, what do? Do I wrangle all my parts like they're animals in a zoo? Because sometimes that's what it feels like. There's a poem that was shared with me in one of my Facebook groups the other day, and I wanted to read it to you. It seemed to leave an impression on several people. And while it's living, because it's Facebook, I'm going to tell you a little bit about how I arrived at where I'm at. Oh, here it is. My brain and heart divorced a decade ago over who was to blame about what big of a mess I've become. Eventually, they couldn't be in the same room with each other. Now my head and heart share custody of me. I stay with my brain during the week, and my heart gets me on weekends. They never speak to each other. Instead, they give me the same note to pass to each other every week. And their notes they send to one another always say the same thing. This is your fault. On Sundays, my heart complains about how my head has let me down in the past. And on Wednesday, my head lists all of the times my heart has screwed things up for me in the future. They blame each other for the state of my life. There's been a lot of yelling and crying. So, lately I've been spending a lot of time with my gut, who serves as my unofficial therapist. Most nights, I sneak out the window in my rib cage and slide down my spine and collapse on my gut's plush leather chair that's always open for me. And I just sit until the sun comes up. Last evening, my gut asked me if I was having a hard time being caught between my heart and my head. I nodded. I said I didn't know if I could live with either of them anymore. My heart is always sad about something that happened yesterday, and my head is always worried about something that may happen tomorrow, I lamented. My gut squeezed my hand. I just can't live with my mistakes of the past or my anxiety about the future, I sighed. My gut smiled and said, in that case, you should probably go stay with your lungs for a while. I was confused. The look on my face gave it away. If you're exhausted about your heart's obsession with the fixed past or your mind's focus on the uncertain future, your lungs are the perfect place for you. There is no yesterday in your lungs. There is no tomorrow there either. There is only now. There is only inhale. There is only exhale. There is only this moment. There is only breath. And in that breath, you can rest while your heart and head work their relationship out. This morning, while my brain was busy reading tea leaves, and while my heart was staring at old photographs, I packed a little bag and walked to the door of my lungs. Before I could even knock, she opened the door with a smile, and as a gust of air embraced me, she said, "What took you so long?" That's a poem by John Rudell. This poem was shared on an internal family systems Facebook group where we all talk about our parts. And as soon as I read it, I was like, wow. It's not an IFS poem, but we can see it through that lens of parts and how they do and don't get along. And we have certain vocabulary for that too, that I can bring in a little bit later. So my name is Morgan. I'm a doctoral student in San Francisco, and I'm studying clinical psychology. And I joined my doctoral program without an undergraduate degree in psychology, which was amazing that this program let me do that. I just had to take a few prerequisites, but I was thinking about why I didn't major in psychology in college. And because I loved psychology, I think I had to take Psych 101 because it was the last one available. I didn't know anything about it, but I loved it. And I loved that it invited me to look at my own thoughts and feelings and behaviors and really look at them. And it was very de-shaming to me to learn all these concepts that I'm not alone. And so I took Psych 101, I took Social Psych, I took Psych Stats, I took, I think, a fourth Psych class, but I didn't major in Psych. I didn't take the 36 credits or whatever it was that was needed to major in Psych. And the reason was that there was a class on the curriculum that just really didn't sound like fun to me. And I'm wondering if anyone can guess what that class might be.
Something about family systems?
Not quite. Might have been interested in how families worked.
Research statistics.
Oh, that I didn't want to take either, but that I don't think that was the kicker. Definitely didn't want to work with rats in the lab.
Adolescent psychology.
Adolescents? No. What?
Abnormal. Abnormal? Abby psych? Yeah.
Abby normal.
Happy normal. That's right.
If I'm not mistaken, this class is still called this. Because it's hard to rename a textbook, I suppose. So, this is like a lot of paper. So I looked at this and I was like, ooh, that sounds dark. That's where I'm going to study criminals. And people that are really hard to work with. This decision when I was 19 has followed me into my profession. Because this is still how we think about psychology and healing a lot of the time, depending on what model you use. We talk about symptoms and where they come from, and we bill for Medi-Cal, and we say that we're going to reduce symptoms from 6 to 4, or to 3 to 4 times a week, to 1 to 2 times a week. That's how we bill for Medi-Cal. That's how we measure our progress. And in my program, we're essentially asked, are you psychodynamic or are you CBT? Are you a psychoanalyst or are you cognitive behavioral? And at the end of 3 years, I decided neither. And I was lucky to have a school that even entertained both, because many schools are one or the other. They don't even let you, they don't even care about letting you explore. So I have a particularly open-minded school. But I had to learn the model that worked for me outside. So where does pathology, as we call it, come from? I had to take assessment, and in assessment we would give people tests, and if they scored a 74, they didn't have a condition. If they scored a 75, they did. And to my, you know, professor's credit, we learned how to write our reports very sensitively. Talk about people's backgrounds, what led them to develop these symptoms. Were there any developmental, you know, issues in childhood? Were there any adverse childhood experiences? I'm so glad we're starting to talk about that now. This is a quote by Deb Donna. She is a polyvagal expert, very into the nervous system, which is very important here. And it's not my area of expertise, but goes very well with this model. All mental disorders can be viewed as some type of adaptive response. Whoa. That really shakes things up. Because if we look at CBT, say, we might talk about cognitive distortions. Your thoughts are distorted. And that's an okay way to think about things compared to how we thought about them before. Because you think if you think about them as distorted, you know, maybe we can correct them. Maybe we can make them right. But there's still an element of not getting to the heart of what distorted them in the first place. So what comes up when you hear the words multiple personality?
Film depictions of varieties of that sort.
Psycho.
Yeah, right.
Psycho.
Sybil, wasn't that the, mm-hmm. the book Sybil. Back in the
70s?
Yeah.
My student who was raped by every male member of her family and used for childhood pornography films.
So the connection between serious chronic trauma, continuous relational trauma, and the development of a condition. Later on. So that reminds me of multiple personalities, how that comes about. So multiple personality disorder, as it was formerly known as, it's now called dissociative identity disorder, is known to be a trauma disorder. So if we think about DID, on one end of the spectrum, we can think of this idea of multiplicity. Some people call it splitting in psychoanalysis. We can think of every human person on this spectrum. And this really blew people out of the water when it was first proposed, because the psychoanalysts thought that splitting was bad. Even if it was came out of trauma, that our goal in therapy is to integrate. To bring all those personalities, those parts together into one solid, cohesive self. So what internal family systems does is it says that we are all naturally multiple and that there is nothing wrong with that. We don't need to make any parts go away. We don't need to kill them off. That's the language that we sometimes use about those things that we think are wrong with us. Ooh, that addiction, I need to make that go away. That part needs to go away. And what IFS does is it gives us a vocabulary and a way inward. Because parts of ourselves, it's not like taking out the trash. And a lot of times we, and as therapists, we think of it this way. So I'm going to give you just a brief history of how IFS came about. There's this fellow named Richard Schwartz. He was a family therapist in the late 70s, early 80s. And family therapy was thought to be revolutionary because he was working with patients with eating disorders, particularly bulimia. And he said, we need to get the parents in here because we can do all this stuff with the kids. But if they go back to these environments that are really invalidating, then they're not going to get better. So he invited the families in, and he started practicing family therapy. It was family systems. And after quite some time, he realized that his patients still weren't getting better. And he started to ask them why. He was starting to despair, really, because he thought by fixing the external system, you could fix the hurt, whatever was going on. So his patients started to talk to him about what was going on inside of them, and they kept using the language of parts. He's like, what do you mean? A part of you wants this, and a part of you wants that. Some of these parts were really intense, and in the field, we see these things as really extreme self-harm parts, suicidal parts, parts that won't let you eat. They feel very self-destructive. We go, why? Why is the body doing this? Why is the mind doing this? And what he found was that most of the parts that he encountered served some kind of protection for the person, even if it seemed really destructive. And so he came up with an organization that's actually fairly simple, and even beyond working with patients with eating disorders, beyond working with patients on death row, he found that this system of organization could apply to virtually anybody. And that's why understanding trauma on a spectrum is really important. Because a lot of people think, I'm not traumatized. What work do I have to do? Or why would I need to do trauma work if I'm not traumatized? And I really like how normalized the idea of attachment trauma or attachment wounds has become, because it allows us permission to do our work and go inside and ask questions of parts of us that are hurt by something. Because we all have them. We've all been hurt at some point in our lives, especially when we were younger and more vulnerable. And we often are living in environments that don't validate our experience. So, can anyone raise their hand if there were certain emotions that were not allowed growing up in your family? What are examples of emotions that weren't allowed?
Anger.
Couldn't be angry. What's another example? It doesn't have to be your example.
Well, some families would just basically not share fear with each other.
Fear. Sometimes fear is seen as weakness. You gotta toughen up. Some children aren't allowed to be sad. Some children aren't allowed to be happy because they have a parent who's sad or a sibling who's sad. So if at any point in our lives, and this doesn't just have to happen with our parents and our families, because our school environments are very influential to us, our teachers, our peers, our early relationships, romantic relationships in life, they all form this kind of idea of who we are and what we're capable of. And if at any time our environment invalidated our full spectrum of emotions, whatever that emotion was that wasn't allowed, we're going to exile it. We're going to put it in a cage or sweep it under a rug and try not to think about it. And if that emotion or any kind of pain that we're carrying gets triggered later in life, there's something that comes along to protect us from that feeling. So the two different parts that have been identified in IFS are, and I just love that this is the case because it absolutely changed my view of healing. Because there was no longer anything to be ashamed of. And shame is one of the biggest things that bring people in. And it might not be verbalized at first. Protectors and exiles. So protector, they've got good intentions. If we can find out what those good intentions are and what they're afraid of is going to happen to the system, if we allow any of that pain that the exile is Holden to be expressed, then we can start to show them compassion and extend that compassion to all the parts in your system. I'll tell you a little bit about what this looks like sometimes in the work, because a lot of people can do the work on their own. There's so many books, podcasts, groups, workshops that you can look at to start to get to know your own inner system, because everyone's system is different. But these rules tend to apply. I found this with all of my clients, I found this with myself. It's very important that this is also the model that I use to understand myself and how I work. So the protector is the one that has a job. It's got a job to do. And the exile is the one that holds the pain. So there's two kinds of protectors. And by the way, this is just vocabulary, and you can make it your own. A lot of, like, I have a client who calls one of her protectors the dragon, because she sees it like a dragon. So some people get very visual with it, and some not so much, and that's okay. Two kinds of protectors. One is called the manager. The manager makes sure that everything goes according to plan. And how might this protect an exile? It means that we're never put in a position where we are made fun of. We're never put in a position where we're vulnerable. Everything is lined up. So if you think of perfectionism as a manager, that's very protective. It's a very powerful protector. And Dick Schwartz, the guy who developed the model, calls them the unsung heroes, because they're carrying a very heavy burden. So whenever we feel like we're not doing enough and we have to just go at the expense of all of our other parts, even the ones that are just like, can't we just play? Can't we just rest? That manager needs to be witnessed, because it's doing a really important job and it doesn't think it can let go. So the perfectionist part, inner critic part, a people-pleasing part. That part that wants to put everybody in front of ourselves. It can also be called a caretaking part. So even within the vocabulary of this system, it can still get really pathologizing. The people pleaser part, the caretaker part. These parts all have inherent gifts and they're not meant to go away. So when we think of the manager, if you think about that, like, oh, why is my anxiety so high? You don't have to make that anxiety go away. It's a negotiation. Instead, you can feel, and this is how we often do it. IFS is it pairs very well with somatic techniques and mindfulness and noticing what's going on in your body, which is incredibly important. Because talking can only take us so far. I'm, as a current talk therapist, I'm probably the first one right now to tell you that without paying attention to our bodies and our nervous systems, it's gonna take way longer to get through whatever we need to get through. So a lot of people come in with, as I'm demonstrating right now, really tense shoulders. A lot of people come in with gastrointestinal complaints, or a sore throat, a lot of tension in the throat. So people know a lot about chakras, know a lot about what that can also signify, not having a voice. But when we pay attention to what's coming up in the body, it makes for a perfect trailhead. And I love this word, trailhead, because it's a really great replacement for the word trigger. Not that there's anything wrong with the word trigger, but it can be triggering. And I think Holden is the perfect place, not just to reinvent language, but to think of our triggers as trailheads. Because there's so many trailheads here. So if anyone came in here during that meditation and thought, wow, I'm I'm coming in this room with a burden. I'm coming in here with a worry or a concern. That could be a trailhead to a part that you've never communicated with on a certain depth before. So the idea of getting to know all of the parts in your system is the first step to being able to show them curiosity and compassion and relieving them of any shame that they're carrying. So we talked about the managers a little bit. Does anyone in here relate to having a manager? Yeah. A couple people. Everyone's got a manager in there. Now, the manager is a good part because it keeps us on task. Oftentimes when children are parentified early in life, when they have to start taking care of themselves very early, or taking care of their siblings, or taking care of their parents, that manager comes online very early. And that manager is a child and needs to be spoken to like a child and cared for like a child. And this is very consistent with, you know, the psychoanalytic idea of arrested development. Sometimes parts of us just get stuck in time. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. We just have to go in and update them. Tell them, hey, I'm 33. I'm getting a doctorate, look at me. I'm not 8 years old anymore. And that's a relationship. That's a relationship that you can build with any parts that are stuck in time. So the manager tries to keep anything bad from happening ever. Those are the parts that really want to control our lives. And in the poem that I read, that would be the head. Always worrying about the future. Never wanting you to mess up. I think as we've all experienced, does most of that anxiety actually impact the future? Does it make anything better? No, but at a healthy level, it keeps us on track. And it's a very valuable part. But what brings it into therapy, say, is the burden that it carries. That if it doesn't do X, Y, Z, and that exile is going to keep thinking it's never going to be enough. So that's the part that is never satisfied. So if we can lessen that burden of shame, then we can start making our way to the exile and let it know. And this is where I want to come to Cynthia's presentation, because I had the wonderful opportunity to go to a lot of the sessions this week and collect these nuggets of wisdom from all of our awesome faculty, all of them. And what Cynthia said was, I could continue to be a bump on a log for the rest of my life, and I would still be beloved. And immediately, I thought of the manager, or any part that believes that love is conditional. And at some point in our lives, haven't we all thought, especially when we were younger, that in order to be loved, in order to belong, I have to be a certain way. I have to do a certain thing, and I have to do it really well. So that part of us is actually quite young. Not actually the age that we are. And it's been a really fascinating discovery. Because when we do IFS therapy and we meet that inner critic, or we meet a manager sometimes, there's a technique. Get that part. Okay, first, locate it in your body. Let's go shoulders or jaw. Jaw is a big one. Go to that feeling. Really feel into it. How does it seem to you? Oh, it seems really angry. How do you feel about it? Well, I'm pissed off at it. I want it to go away. Okay. Could you ask that part of you that's pissed off at it to take a step back? So that we can get to know that part a little bit more. This is how parts get really tangled. Because the way that we feel about a part, that's a part. All right, could you get that angry part to take a little step back? Let us have some time with that feeling of tension, that feeling of anxiety. okay, that part took a step back. Now how do you feel about that part? Wow, I feel sorry for it. It looks like it's working really hard. And that's where we go from being blended with a part to being in self. And that's the last, these are the last vocabulary words I'm introducing. Capital S, self. This has a lot of spiritual implications. What are we when we are in self? A lot of other spiritual and religious traditions have their own word for it. In Hinduism, there's a term for it. In the mystical traditions, Sufism, can't remember them all. IFS actually isn't billed as a spiritual practice. People have just taken it and ran. But when we're in self, that means we're not blended with any of our parts. And what is blending? Just taking taking a step back and looking at that part of us, that part of us that's anxious, that part that's depressed, that part that really wants a drink, be any part. And when we unblend, it means that we are able to show it curiosity and show it compassion. Find out what it's afraid of. What is it afraid of would happen if it stopped doing its job? So the one that's not the controller, the manager, is called a firefighter. And it's also a very well-intentioned part. Okay. The firefighter is what happens when the pain of the exile is already triggered. So as we know in Holden, firefighters come out, they put out the flames. They put out the fire, and that's their job, because they think that the pain of the exile is out of control. That fire is going to burn the entire system down. It might burn down more than that. It might hurt somebody else. So the fear of the pain of the exile is so intense that the firefighter will go to any length to extinguish it. And what methods does it like to use? Alcohol, drugs, any kind of behavioral addiction, could be the internet. And again, at certain levels, these are all very nice parts. They just want you to feel good. So they all have naturally valuable states. But when they get inducted into this role, they just want you to feel good at any cost. So sometimes, in the cases of more extreme trauma, you get dissociation. You just lose time. It's a very common thing that we see. Even if you're just like slightly spacey, daydreamy, foggy, I felt that for a lot of my life, and there's definitely an escape element to it. I definitely, I read a lot of fantasy as a kid because I didn't know what to do with my anxiety. I would just go into somebody else's world. Food. Food is huge because it's that thing that we need. So how do we regulate it when it becomes a tool of soothing? So it's possible to have compassion for firefighters. Now what happens a lot of the time, in the case of the poem that I read, and there's so many different words for this in different models of therapy, but they start fighting each other big time. You ever notice when you have I'll speak for myself, one too many glasses of wine or five bowls of tuna casserole? My manager gets really annoyed with me. And yesterday I actually did feel like slightly physically ill because of all the cream, so that's just biology. But my manager was just like, couldn't you have stopped at two bowls of tuna mac, one glass of wine, one less episode of Queen's Gambit? Because then I wake up in the morning and I'm really tired. So my manager is a big shamer. Because it thinks I'm never going to get to where I need to go. And so neither this manager or this firefighter thinks that me, myself, can steer the ship. So they become so overinflated and self-important that they take over the steering wheel. And that is what Internal Family Systems describes as the source of pathology, is when your parts become so inflated in your system that there's very little room for you to be in self, which is unblended and leading your own system. And there's a big spiritual element to that. Now the exile.
Could I ask a quick clarification?
Yes, please, Cynthia.
Why in family, internal family systems theory, is the self capitalized?
I think just because the word self is used so much that they want to distinguish it from not capital S self.
Sure, sure.
And that it's important. Or maybe we give it a kind of divinity. Yes.
I have a question too. Like, does this internal family systems, how does it manage like biology? Like, is it assumed that if nothing bad ever happened to you, you'd be perfect, but you wouldn't have developed these things?
So the idea, and actually there's been a lot of great debate about this, and I've loved seeing how the model has evolved over time, because it started out so puny. Like Richard Schwartz was just like, wow, I really stumbled upon something really great. I hope someone can take it into fruition. And over 33 years, he's like, I guess that person's me. So he's put on the conferences, and it's grown and grown and grown and grown so that people have made it their own. And the neuroscientists have made it their own. And the people that specialize in eating disorders, disordered eating, have made it their own. So there's so many different ways to approach it. And I think the way that it relates to the body is really, really important part of the conversation, because our parts show up somatic. They show up in our body. And so, yeah, there's a lot of folks that are in, you know, polyvagal theory, talking about just how trauma works in the brain. Where is self in the body? And that's a great question. I understand it just through the language of parts. And this little illustration, which I was reading on the boat up here, actually really helped me understand what parts work can do. Because say someone comes into therapy, or you're just wherever you are, and you got little parts, you got big parts, some are managers, some are exiles, and they're taking up all this space in the system. This is self in here, and self is going, oh my gosh, I don't even exist. And you could go into therapy with someone, and their parts are like, oh, this person doesn't have a self. We are running the show. Because we can't trust him. We can't trust Daryl to live his life because he messed up or he abandoned us in our trauma. That's often what an exile will say. They'll say, self abandoned me, self left the body. And they won't have any relationship with self. And so in order to get into self, got these 8 C's. It's a device. Calm, confident, courageous, curious, compassionate, connected. There are 2 others that I can't remember. But a bunch of C words. My favorite are curious and compassionate. Mm-hmm. If we're embodying those things, then that's a way of feeling in self. Because we're able to extend those things to our parts and not be blended with them. So if self starts out really tiny here, it's a system is really crowded by parts. And the reason these parts are so big is not because they were naturally that way. It's because the burdens that they're carrying are so heavy. One of these, grief, that was never allowed to be released and worked through because the environment wasn't safe. or the person just didn't know how to work through grief. This one. Anxiety, concern about the future.
Are you naming exiles right now?
Anxiety could be a manager.
I know.
Too. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anxiety and depression can actually cover any kind of part. What happens through unblending and the practice of meeting your parts is that things get harmonious. Your parts get along with each other, and you have a trusting relationship with your parts. So that manager, you can build a relationship with that manager and say, hey, I really appreciate how hard you're working. I know that you had to be perfect at one point, or you felt like you had to be perfect. Is it okay that you give me a little bit of space so I can work with that part of me that feels like it wasn't enough? And I think we'd be hard-pressed to find anyone in the world that didn't feel that at one point in their life, that they weren't enough, that they weren't deserving of love by either their caretakers, their peers. Are there any parts that are coming up for people as I'm talking about this?
Grief.
What?
Grief.
Grief. The knowledge that grief can take up so much space in our system? Absolutely.
Can you give some more examples of exiles?
Mm-hmm.
Before you do, I got a little bit lost on how protectors relate to exiles. So
yep.
Again,
so the protectors are protecting the exiles. One of my clients described it as if she had a little prison inside of her, and all of her exiles were locked up in that prison, and it was guarded by an army. She was very visual. And I found this with a couple of my clients. They're very visual. And it's actually quite delightful to work with parts in that way. Because they are just so present. And it's not fun to have your parts present around you all the time, especially if they get really combative and confusing. But it makes for really good healing work. So I do want to touch on grief, and I appreciate that you brought that up, because the idea of unburdening is one of the greatest discoveries of IFS, is that if our parts all have good intentions, and they're all innately good, and they're not meant to go away, what do we do with those burdens? What do we do with those burdens that they're carrying? One, we can ask them, literally, how much of this is yours and how much of this is someone else's? That gets into the territory of legacy burdens. These are burdens that are inherited by us, passed down by our parents or our grandparents or our ancestors, and any pain that they experienced. So if you ask a manager, say, or even a firefighter, how much of this is yours and how much of this is someone else's? Oftentimes they'll actually answer you, like, oh, about half-half. They'll say, I don't know, 70-30. And then you can help them release what doesn't belong to them. The simple awareness that not that much of their burden doesn't belong to them, it's almost like a melting. Wait, this isn't something that I have to carry, even though it's something that I want to heal in my family line. And then this one shrinks to this size, and we're on our way to growing self and growing our ability to lead our own system without being blended. So the protector, I'll give an example. I have a client who met a part who was a 19-year-old lady in a leather jacket, kind of a butch lady in a leather jacket. She was real tough, didn't really like my client at all. She was very suspicious. She was like, so we did the work of saying, hey, how do you feel towards it? Ooh, I feel a little intimidated. Okay, let's ask that intimidated part to step back. And then we really met that protector. It was a source of great anxiety for my client. And we found out that that biker chick, as we called it, was protecting a little boy. My client identifies as female, and she was very confused by this. She's like, why is my exile a boy? It's like, I don't know, let's just meet it. Let's meet it where it's at. And that exile was a little boy crouched on the ground, rocking back and forth, and it kept saying, failure, failure, failure. And to this day, we've been working together for a couple of months. Those two parts are still paired. The protector still hasn't allowed that little boy to unburden. And I can tell you a little bit about the unburdening process, because it takes quite a bit of care and quite a bit of training. Oftentimes, the exile has a memory that they're stuck in. Could be a memory from a parent, it could be being bullied in school, anything that just caused a lot of pain and shame. So what you can do, for one, depending on the age of the exile, is just be with it. Let it know that you're there. It's known as reparenting in a lot of literature that you'll find. Some people will call it like self-help, do your inner child work. And this is what that is, essentially. It's inner child work and it's reparenting. It's being the parent to your exile that they need it. And oftentimes you have wonderful, willing parents that will do that healing work with you. A lot of people do not have that willingness from their parents or the people that you need that support from. So you can be with that exile. Ask it to tell you its story. Because that part usually didn't have a place to go to share its story and to not just share its story and its experience, but what it felt about it. They say trauma is not what happens to us, it's how we experienced it. Mm-hmm. So you could go through something that someone would call traumatic and not be traumatized because you had the support that you needed. You were able to heal from it. But if you're not able to heal from it, then it's going to stay stuck. It's going to stay stuck in your body. And so once you, as part of the unburdening process, and with this particular client that I described, we're doing it very slowly, because a lot of those parts are very suspicious. They're like, nah, self doesn't care about us, self left us. And this is huge, because in our culture, we're not encouraged to go inside. We're not encouraged to be in touch with our bodies and those different parts of our psyche. We're encouraged to distract. And what is that distraction but a firefighter? Because it doesn't want you to know what's in there. The story at the end of the day, to me, is that we can go in there. Because whatever's in there just needs our love. And it needs our attention. And it needs to be witnessed. So to witness that exile, get that full story of a therapist, a facilitator will say, does it feel like you got it? Does it feel like you understand how hard that was? And then you might say, yeah, I've got it. It's happy, it's satisfied, it thinks that I understand it. Okay, now you're going to go back to that time with it and be there with it in the way that it wanted you to be there. So in the example of a kid that was bullied, some exiles will ask you to like beat the bully up or something, but that's not the case all the time. Or that part might just want you to hold its hand. Whatever corrective experience, as we call it, is needed for that exile to feel supported in its time of pain. And then what we do, we take that exile out of there. That's some wizardry. I'll ask my clients, So, where does that part want to go? She was like, ooh, a field of lavender. After being stuck in a traumatic memory for that long, a field of lavender sounds pretty nice. Another client said, Ooh, he really wants to pet horses. So we took it to a horse stable and left it in a horse stable so it could pet horses. Oftentimes we can identify a part in the body that it wants to live at. One client said, I really want it to live on my left shoulder so that I can keep checking in with it. Or I really want it to live in a room in my heart. So these problems, these traumas, these symptoms that we're talking about, they're parts that aren't meant to go away because they're naturally valuable to us. Can someone name a gift of a child that might get forgotten over time? What are the gifts of children?
Spontaneity.
What?
Spontaneity.
Spontaneity, yes.
Curiosity.
Play. Play.
Simple pleasures.
Being present.
Yes, absolutely. Oh my goodness. Being kids just remind us how not present we are. Mm. We're just like, yes, all part of our little manager assortment here. And kids will pull us into the present. So our exiles, they're not just little burdened people. They have gifts that we've forgotten. They have gifts that they've had to hide away because they weren't safe. It wasn't safe to be childlike. They had to grow up, they had to toughen up. So it's not just enough to unburden a part. We have to call in the gifts that they lost. And this I just love how all this stuff is framed because I see it like Indiana Jones pulling that thing off the altar and switching it with something else. We're not unburdening our parts because oftentimes our systems are so addicted to those burdens, they don't know what to do without them. And can you imagine that? If our burdens become such a huge part of our story, taking them away is like taking away a piece of our identity. Which is why in some cases, if Jewish clients are unburdening parts of their generational trauma, let's say, they're like, well, I don't know what to do without that. I don't know what to do without that. That's my culture. That's my identity. That's my family relationships. So what do you do with that? You call in the gifts. Call in the gifts of resilience. Call in the gifts of family. Of whatever values you have. And that can allow that generational healing to happen. Yes?
So one of the things I carry around with me is compartmentalizing things.
Oh, yeah.
Now, is that the manager or the firefighter that's doing that for me?
Well, it sounds like something that keeps things very neat and in control.
Yeah. And I don't have to look at them. I can go on to other things. Well, uh-huh. I mean, I do have to look at them, but eventually. But I mean, it's sort of like it's a survival thing.
Mm-hmm. And why is there a problem?
I don't know that it is.
Okay.
Not for me. It's,
sure.
It might be later on.
Well, because every part has, they might have gifts, they might have burdens, but not all parts are a problem. Not all parts are burdened. They're just aspects of our personality that are unique to us. So if it ever becomes inflated and it uses that compartmentalization to avoid something, for example, mm-hmm. then it could be a manager. It could it could be promoting itself to a managerial role, and you might have to check in with it and be like, hey, thanks. What are we avoiding here? So I'd love to leave room for just a couple of questions because we only have 5 minutes left, but that is what I have to share. Yes?
So I didn't get to hear the beginning of meditation, but is the understanding of meditation a way of sort of connecting to that bigger self?
Yes, absolutely.
So you can listen to that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that up because mindfulness meditation, like we did a short mindfulness meditation, oftentimes you're encouraged to view your thoughts as if they were clouds in the sky or leaves on a stream. And it's very similar to what we do by going inside and noticing, okay, if anyone's ever tried to go to sleep and this thought keeps looping around, that's a part that's really worried about something. And you can talk to that part. But we're not letting it fly by. It can be very calming. I love mindfulness meditation, to just see them as floating by and not being attached to them. And the process of parts work is actually having a conversation with those things. So they're not leaving. We're with them. We're present. And when they, you know, maybe at night you can still treat it like a cloud in the sky, like, I know you, I'll come back to you tomorrow, but you're gonna need to let me sleep tonight. So it's a conversation, yeah.
Do you think that the protectors and the exiles and these dynamics that you're talking about might pertain not only to individuals but also like societies? Mm. Like as a society, we've exiled the shame of slavery.
Yes. Exiled humans. Thank you for bringing that up, Cynthia, because I think that's going to be the wrap-up thought and really what I'm trying to integrate this with in terms of our weekly programming and what we do at Holden, which is that this system of our internal world is unthinkable to so many people. And what we come across, it's very cliche in therapy. If you ask someone, what would you tell a friend in your position? Chances are they'd offer 5,000 times more compassion to their friend than they would to themselves. Mm-hmm. So the idea of offering curiosity and compassion to the exiles and the parts in your system does not come easily to a lot of people. And I want to liken that to our social and political values. If we think of exiles, the field of psychology is dark on this one. If we think about exiling the mentally ill, and forgetting about them. If we think about exiling the refugees to detention centers and forgetting about them, we know in our hearts that exiling people is wrong. So why do we do it to ourselves? And that's where systems theory is, keeps us in check. So I'd love to talk to everyone more about this, because I know this is just a seed and it's a lot for 1 hour, but I really want to thank you for being present here with me and for practicing extending that compassion to not just your parts, but everybody's parts in this room, because it's quite an implication to recognize that not only are we multiple, but the person next to us is multiple too. That deserves some curiosity.
Thank you.
Yeah.